Welcome back to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. On today's show, we have Mike Johnson, Director of Materials, International Living Future Institute. Living-future.org. He's on LinkedIn. Mike Johnson is a net positive visionary and sustainability professional whose decades-long career path has led him from environmental restoration, fieldwork, and social entrepreneurship to corporate executive leadership. As Director of Materials at the International Living Future Institute, the ILFI, he focuses on creating global scale market transformation towards the manufacturing of goods that will build an equitable, healthy, and regenerative future. Mike's understanding of how commerce is a powerful force in the balance of the planet, people, and economy has enabled his sustainability initiatives to grow from startup level to industry recognized and leading edge in various organizations. He brings an ability to offer real-world context, and practical solutions to individuals and organizations seeking to create net positive benefits. He is a founding member of the Living Product 50, a frequent presenter in the ADNC and educational communities, a volunteer with sustainability groups, a full-time dog dad, and an advocate for wilderness, Greg Eric. But before we get to our conversation with Mike Johnson, we got to keep it locked down, locked up, locked in place with GripLock. Go to GripLockSystems.com, Greg Eric.
Hey, that's right. From the ceiling down to the fixture, they provide everything needed to suspend your light fixture. They have individual components and also package kits that come either with the canopy and couplers or the power cord, aircraft cable, grippers, everything you need. And the gripper is their unique self-locking, completely adjustable device, securely lock onto a large range of cables, and no tools to adjust up and down or down or up as often as you'd like. Easy to roll.
Easy to roll. Roll it with GripLockSystems.com. Of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Go to NALD.org. If you got light bulbs in a warehouse, you should probably join us. We're your association. Welcome to the show, Mike Johnson.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No problem.
So we've got a few things we want to ask you, but first of all, just give us a rundown on what the International Living Future Institute is, or when it started, what it's all about.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. That's quite the mouthful, isn't it? The International Living Future Institute. It's always a hard one for even me to say. I practice that pretty much daily. We are really here with one mission in mind, and it's pretty simple. It's to redefine or to define for some people what good looks like in the world. And our particular purview is really in the built space, in the built environment. So we look at what does the good look like in terms of new buildings, restoring buildings, remodeling buildings, entire communities and spaces, affordable housing. And then in my specific area of expertise, we look at what building materials, what does it look like to be good in the building materials space? And that involves everything from the healthfulness of the ingredients that go into the product so that all workers along the supply chain are protected, as well as the user of the final product. It goes into the social equity of how those materials are manufactured and dealt with during and after their life cycle. And it also, of course, goes into the environmental attributes of those products, how they're made, how they're used, what kind of impact they have. So it's really looking at the triple bottom line across the built environment.
So if you were going to pick a product that, you know, we don't have to talk lighting, or maybe it is lighting, but what is an example of a product that does it right from, you know, beginning to end?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. And I think one that I would point to are in our Living Product Challenge program. The Living Product Challenge, to achieve full certification, requires independent scientific validated information that shows that the world is actually left in better condition than had the product not been made throughout its entire life cycle.
That's so impossible.
Human scale.
That's impossible.
It's a challenge.
You know, it sounds impossible, but it's not. It's actually quite feasible, and it's being done now. We have just crossed the mark of about 56 different products that have achieved certification of some sort or another. And we have a handful that have achieved full certification. And full certification means net positive in areas of carbon, health, equity, water, and energy. So it's literally leaving the planet in better condition on all those fronts. It's a holistic challenge to get there. And it's scientifically validated and third-party verified. So it's not just impossible. It's more than possible, and it's being done. And we're the Living Product Challenge really gives us a platform, a framework of how to do that and how to show other manufacturers to do that.
So what is the one of the tops? I think you said four that have done it all the way fully certified?
There's actually quite a few Living Product Challenge certified products out there. Human Scale is one of our manufacturers, one of our champions that has achieved full living. But we can also look at really large international corporations like Mohawk Industries, who have achieved entire platforms of products in their carpeting lines, also on the pedal certification, which is one step shy of hitting every mark. There's 20 different imperatives, and they've hit 17, 18, 19. Some of them are just really elusive, really hard to achieve. But the fact that they're able to do regenerative in any of the categories is absolutely noteworthy. Should be celebrated and should be copied the world over.
So what is it like? Can you define what the product is? And like, so it's manufactured where, and why is it good? Because it's manufactured there and it can get reused. Is that, that's basically what you're saying, right?
Yeah, that's a really nice summary of it. So when we're looking at circular economies, I know you're hearing probably a lot of talk about circular economies right now. And part of what's happened in manufacturing for the past 100 years is we've done a linear extraction manufacturing and use stage. So in lighting, for example, you create that light from a whole variety of pieces of the supply chain. You put it together in some factory somewhere. Then it goes, it gets installed. And then let's just take, you know, an average case scenario in a commercial setting. Somebody gets sick of that lighting fixture in 5 years because their palette changes. That thing comes out and goes to the landfill. All of that, all of the inputs that created that lighting fixture are lost as soon as it gets torn out and put into the landfill. That's a complete waste of everything that went into there. So in order to achieve the challenge that we're talking about here, a manufacturer would have to know the entire supply chain, have to first of all make sure that there are none of the worst case scenario chemicals going into that lighting fixture. ILFI has what's called our red list. And our red list is right now about 12,500 different Casrin numbers or chemical compound numbers that are uniquely identified as being some of the worst offenders commonly put into everyday products. Now, when you consider the fact that most North Americans will spend 90% of their lives indoors, surrounded by chemicals, surrounded by products, surrounded by building materials, of which we have almost no information available on their ingredients, you start to really wonder about the impacts to the human health. So that's where really where we start. We start by saying, hey, you manufacturers, you need to be transparent. Just like our food, you need to tell us what's going into your products so that we know if it's safe. And if it's not safe, how do we handle it to make sure that it is as safe as possible? And then we carry it forward and we say, are you taking a look at all of the environmental and social equity impacts of your manufacturing all the way along its life cycle? And then we take it further and we say for lighting manufacturers, because in lighting, a lot of the impact is going to come from operational impact and not the supply chain impact. So once you install that lighting, if you have hyper-efficient lighting, fantastic, you're doing a great thing for the world. If you happen to have vastly inefficient lighting, or even more to the point in your world, if you have the wrong lighting, the wrong color, the wrong temperature, the wrong style, then you've done a gigantic disservice because you have not installed the product that's going to perform well in its application for the longest time. And then we're adding to that, we're saying you also need to be responsible for before the life, during life, and an end of life disposition of that lighting. Lots of words there, huh?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think, like, so this is your guys' thing. Who put it together? What year did they put it together? That kind of stuff. Where does that come from?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really, I think, a combination. It's a collaboration of a lot of minds in the industry. So in the early 2000s, USGBC came out with LEED, which I'm sure you're very familiar with LEED. Mm-hmm. There are other international green building challenges. And in the early 2000s, it came to pass that there was not a green building challenge that was really pushing the limits, that was really being the spearhead and saying, not let's do less bad, but let's go beyond that paradigm and start to restore the planet, restore human health, and increase social equity and human healthfulness by creating a challenge that seems, as was mentioned a little bit earlier, impossible, but actually it's not impossible. We set those standards to really stretch. We stretch for the moon, we stretch for Mars, and we want to make sure that those goals are cutting edge and challenging the best minds to come up with the best solutions. So all this started in about 2003 to 2006. The first red list that I mentioned earlier only had 13 chemicals on it. That was in 2006. Fast forward 15 years or so to today, and like I mentioned, we have almost 12,500 chemicals on that red list. And we are seeing the achievement of not only products being made in a regenerative and restorative third-party verified sense, but we're also seeing over 900 buildings worldwide participate in our challenges and also achieving regenerative and restorative status.
What do they get if they accomplish the challenge or beat it or win that or whatever you want to say?
You know, I think that's a variation on one of my on one of my favorite questions, because it's such a hard question to answer. And it's a hard question to answer only because of our paradigm. Our paradigm right now in business and in pretty much everything that we are taught to do every day professionally comes down to three letters, ROI, right? Return on investment. The problem is somewhere along the way, we forgot that return on investment has got to be a return on more than just a financial investment. There really is no point of investing and getting profits if we don't have a planet that's worthy of living upon or that can support life. So we really need to change the paradigm and start thinking about the profit or the return on what we actually want in terms of financial, social, health, and equity, because that builds longevity, right? And that builds a world that we want to invest in, and then we can envision a better future for everybody. So what do they get? They actually get, number one, a survivable planet. Number two, they get supply chains that aren't running out of finite resources, which is happening pretty quickly around the world. Number three, they're getting communities that are resilient to climate change or to any other of the natural resource impacts that we are imposing upon ourselves or that we just have as a limitation on Earth. I mean, we have to remember, and we can never forget this, we are now at 8 billion people on this planet. We are projected to be over 10 billion by 2050. And all of those people need basic access to basic resources. And we're already limiting it to the point where they don't. So the return is a better future, as well as better financial returns for the bottom line, as well as resiliency against shocks, for example, in insurance, in reputation, and the very existence based upon your supply chains.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up exposure to chemicals. Okay, so I'm gonna make something that's totally has nothing to do with lighting, and then I'll try to loop it back to lighting. So, for example, I don't like the hardwood floor in my house, and I'm gonna tell you why. It was put in about 2006, and it has like this special coating that's gonna make this engineered wood floor last for 50 years. And I wonder what's in that coating, actually. Nowhere on the box of that floor. I walk on that floor in my bare feet all the time. And I've often wondered, like, how come they can have a floor that lasts 50 years that's basically a picture of wood with a little bit of, like, a pencil shaving of wood. You know, they shave the log like a pencil. And they spread it out over another board. And then they put some kind of crazy compound on top of it. 50 years, buddy. You have 50 years in that floor. What the hell am I walking on, Mike? You know what I'm saying? Like, what is this 50-year floor? So I wonder to myself, like, yeah, there needs to be some product labeling. You guys started with 13 chemicals. Now we're at 12,000 or 13,000, you said? So you're saying that there are products that you've taken from being, you know, not so bad to now benefiting or in some way absorbing some of our negative and all that sort of stuff. How do you get to clean energy? Because to me, the problem, number one problem in your world, is not where the stuff comes from so much or this and that. It's that the energy that takes it to various places. How do you verify the energy side of it?
Okay, to use a purposeful pun, sounds like you've got some light bulb moments going off here. So let's start with your floor. Your floor, I don't know what particular floor or coating you have, but you're asking the right question. What is in this? What am I walking on? What am I doing, for example, when I use a cleaner? And am I bringing out a toxic compound that's going to get into my skin through dermal absorption or into my pet's feet or my children's feet, right? So the question that you raise is the question that everybody should raise about every single product they touch every day. And that's what we're doing. Now, the answer to your specific question, I'm going to give a plug here real quickly. There is a company called Mafi, M-A-F-I, Mafi Flooring. They do all natural wood flooring and everything else that is related and that has been through the full living product challenge. They are a wonderful company. Now, ILFI, the organization for which I work, we have a program called Declare. The Declare Transparency Program, it's voluntary for manufacturers because there are no laws in the United States that require disclosure of chemicals in products for buildings. So it's voluntary. But when a manufacturer goes through that process, what they're doing is they're saying, hey, we agree that our clients ought to know what's going into the products that we use, and they ought to know what its end of life is. And so what they do is they voluntarily list 100% of all intentionally added ingredients and known residuals down to 100 parts per million. And I won't go into a long explanation, but 100 parts per million is a very, very minuscule amount. And then they screen it against our red list to make sure that it does not contain any of those 12,500 chemicals. Now, one more thing that I want to mention because we're on this show, another absolute superstar rock star in this world is called Superior Essex. Superior Essex puts together communication cable and other sorts of cable. And what they have done is extraordinary. They have gone through and navigated, and this is important, I think, for your audience. They've navigated the extremely fine line that exists between chemicals that go into a product by necessity, by fire code, which are known to be carcinogenic or hazardous. So for example, PVC has a host of health problems that is known, and a host of environmental problems that is well known and documented, but National Fire Code requires PVC or a similar product to go into plenum space, right? So Superior Essex is the one company that has tackled this. They have taken it upon themselves to remove PVC from some of their communications cable and then research the very best alternative that also matches fire code, and they've got that in there. So here's where it gets a little bit twisty and turny for everybody. Unfortunately, even the newest invention that they've got, even the newest chemistry that they have, now has been added to our list of 12,500 as part of the PFAS or the PFAS compounds list, because it also has known or suspected problems associated. But they've gone through the additional steps still, and they said, we have to meet fire code. We have to be able to put wire in plenum space until architects and designers stop designing for plenum space. And then what we're going to do is we're going to have it independently assessed by toxicologists to know that it's the safest possible alternative for today. And at the same time, we're going to work on all the environmental aspects and all the social equity aspects to make sure that product is, again, meeting that definition of what does good look like. The final part of your question. You had added an energy question. And I believe your added energy question is, what do we do about the energy required to ship products around, if I heard your
question? And make the products themselves and use the electricity, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few things. Number one, renewable energy is coming down in cost so rapidly and increasing in efficiency so strongly that we're seeing, of course, now it's well known that the cost of coal-fired power plants, it makes them ridiculous from a cost feasibility standpoint. Renewables have dropped so that almost everybody can do them. So the real problem is in your demand amount of electricity, not your overall electrons used, but the demand that you need, as well as storage. So we're starting to see some really creative solutions on how do we, number one, reduce the amount of energy required for a product. And we do that through what's called hot spotting in life cycle analysis. We identify where the most energy is used and how we can transform the process, or maybe even the ingredients, to lessen that energy. And then number two, we have renewable energy installations or power purchasing agreements in place to cover the actual electrons and demand used. And then number three, we're looking at the facility level to make sure that those are being as efficient as possible. And then downstream, when we're looking into the supply chain, we want to know what kind of impacts can we have on our suppliers? And what can we do with our final end users also to make sure that, say, a lighting fixture is as efficient as possible while meeting the performance requirements that are necessary? So a long-winded answer to say there is no easy answer. The only easy answer is the one that Jimmy Carter gave 35 years ago. That's use less, right? Use less. Be wise and use less. We can do that, and we can couple it with modern resources and modern technology, and we can very easily get to the energy demands. We can get those covered through renewables.
The when you're dealing with a light bulb or a light fixture, have you guys investigated or do you have any standards around the light itself that the product creates? So, for example, you know, there is a lot of evidence emerging that LED radiation is, you know, in certain ways, we don't know for sure yet, but we've just heard it in our work that flicker and LED radiation is not the same as incandescent light. And while it's more efficient and perhaps it's better that it's made in China or made in Canada or wherever the heck it's made according to your specifications, do you guys actually look at the light coming from the LED TV at people and what kind of chemical processes happen to humans when they're exposed to this kind of light? Or is that something that hasn't entered your calculus yet?
No, that's a really great question. And in fact, for full disclosure, I was the director of sustainability for a lighting manufacturer for many years. And even back then, we were looking at the effects of, say, circadian rhythm. We were looking at the effects of exactly what you're saying, the radiation and the wavelengths and performance and all of that. So I think one way to sum up what we do at the Institute, we don't actually do studies. We create standards. And then we help people through those standards. So we rely on external experts to show us that data and inform us with that data. To meet that as quickly as we need to meet that, we have what many other folks have, which is called a technical action group. We recruit some of the industry experts in each of the areas that we need more knowledge. We find out what they know. We find out whether there's collaborative agreement across the experts. And that's the direction that we take for recommendations in our standards. So the long answer is yes, we're looking at all of these, but we don't actually do the scientific studies. We rely on our scientific partners to help do that and our industry partners. But we do bring that all together, the best known information of the day, and put that into our standard.
How do you deal with improperly used equipment? So, for example, you could take a light fixture and point it in the wrong direction and create a whole bunch of light trespass and light pollution with it. Is there a way in which your standard or your what you guys are doing impacts how people use the devices that they purchase?
Yeah, so there is. That would be mostly found in our living building challenge and not in our living product challenge. And at the product level, we expect the manufacturer, and in fact enforce this, that the product is made to be long-lasting and well-performing for its intended purpose, but also that can be taken back at the end of life. So we count on the manufacturer to make sure that the user is well-informed and getting the product they need. On the building side, that's where we can have a little more impact on things like dark sky friendly lighting, turtle friendly lighting, and start to look at some of the other light pollution aspects. So that's where we can ride into the Living Building Challenge standard. We don't want this in this area or this meets the needs. Because the other thing we have to really take into account, of course, is place. Place is one of the most important petals. Petals are what we call our imperative areas. And place has so much to do with usage, right? You want to really protect the dark night sky anywhere around wildlife that can be impacted or anywhere around a national park or national treasure like that. It becomes not less important on the entirety scale, but it becomes less important when you're looking at a city scale. Likewise, we want to make sure that we're doing that with performance applied criteria to every aspect of every site and project, not product, but that's our Living Building Challenge side.
You guys operate in a extended producer responsibility model, right? So you're turning to the manufacturers and you're saying, these are your products, even if you sell them, they're still yours. What are some of the limitations that we see with EPR that are problematic because, you know, the the components, the pieces of equipment are 3, 4, 5 transactions away in different countries and all this kind of stuff. What are some of the limits of the EPR model, and what's the next stage beyond EPR? Because from my perspective, and I'll just preface this, Mike, the EPR model is like a good starting place, right? Let's talk to the people that make this stuff, right? And then we can see where we can go from there. The problem I see from the lighting perspective when it comes to, like, for example, mercury containing lighting waste, okay, is that the manufacturers have no idea where the old light bulbs are. They have no idea where they're going to send them, what province or state or country they're in, and all these different things. And so they have to pay into these programs, and the programs are saying they're doing something about it, but nobody knows where the garbage is. Right, this is a problem, especially in the lighting waste area of this, you know, mercury containing lighting waste. That's a big problem. When do we go beyond the EPR model, or are we going to go beyond the EPR model into more of a user responsibility model, or like a consumer responsibility model?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in there. We could do a 3-hour show just on what you just asked. So I'm going to try to cut to the chase and identify the problems and identify some of the existing solutions and identify some of the growing trends real quickly here. One of the most important problems out there is we have a mindset of use and throw away. That's the number one problem. If we don't break the mindset that we're not responsible for what we create and purchase and use, then we're not going to get out of that. Unfortunately, upholding that problem and enabling that problem is we don't have an accurate cost model for what trash is or what disposal is. If we actually had to pay the costs that are represented by disposing any of our materials all the way through the life cycle, all the way through everything that was invested in there, we would be in a completely different paradigm, but there is no political will for that almost anywhere. The other real problem that we have in terms of getting to where we need to be is we are not set up well in this country for product as a service models or lease models. So not picking on any industry, but let's take the lighting industry. If every lighting manufacturer had to have a product as a service model where they had to go out there and change out those bulbs and take full responsibility for what they put in the first place, or they had to take back those items when they were done with their product as a service period or the lease period, then they could actually own them, disassemble them, design for disassembly. They would be designing and creating in ways that they would be benefiting from taking them back instead of benefiting by a linear throughput. So those are three major problems. Now, the positive side of all of this is I mentioned it before, and I'm sure you've heard it a lot. There's a huge buzz around the concept of circular economy or circularity.
Yeah, sure.
And that's great because circularity is saying, let's look at all lifestyle or all life cycle stages of a product, including extended producer responsibility, consumer responsibility, and end of life disposition for disassembly, recycling, reuse, etc. So if we can get there, if we can take this energy around that, and we can take all this corporate ESG energy that's on circularity, in a true fashion, then we're going to get there very quickly, along with some greatly, desperately needed legislation to help stem the tide of what's being disposed. Now, the final thing that needs to be said to be very clear on the subject, I shouldn't say final, but final for now, we went back and talked about material transparency a little bit earlier. We need to go back to that, because what you cannot do in any municipality in the country or any country in the world, you cannot properly and safely recycle something if you don't know what's in it, right? If you have one light bulb that's containing mercury and you have another light bulb that does not contain mercury, but they look identical and they're not marked otherwise, and there's no transparency, then you cannot recycle those light bulbs together because you might have mercury contamination of the non-containing bulb. And this goes for this goes for furniture, it goes for computers, it goes for tables, it goes for coatings, it goes for, you know, carpeting, every product. If we don't know what goes into it, then we don't know what's coming out of it, and we can't recycle it safely and properly worldwide in a consistent and reasonable fashion.
So anybody that talks about the remanufacture of existing light fixtures in the field has never been involved with the removal of light fixtures from a building. Like, I hate to break the news to everybody, okay? Like, I hear these different groups, they talk about circular economy. Can't we take the lights back and make something different from them? And listen, I recycle thousands of light bulbs every day, okay? And I remember talking to this one group, not-for-profit, and they're like, you know, we'd love to have you guys a part of our program, but, you know, you guys only deal in kilograms, and we need to know how many of each type of light you're recycling. And I turned to them and I said, Mike, you know, you want me to count these? And they said, yeah, can't you tell us how many of this and how many of that you're recycling? And I said, that would take thousands of years. Because when you receive back a box of mixed waste light bulbs, CFLs, incandescents, halogens, and all this sort of stuff, it is dangerous to start sticking your hands in that glass. That needs to go to a mercury management facility right away. And it needs to be processed in a way where the mercury is retorted from that. And so, you know, a lot of times I hear from, you know, I'm glad that I'm listening, talking to you, and I hear some common sense mixed into what you're saying. But when I talk to a lot of people about the circular economy or about, you know, reuse of materials, I can tell that they have no idea what they're talking about, actually, because they've never recycled a light bulb in their life, or they've never done a lighting project where they remove 4,000 2x4s from a property and change them out, and what condition those come out at, and how difficult the installation of them is electrically, and what damages happens. It's just scrap metal. So, you know, I would say this. I think my opinion, Mike, is we need to start with the hazardous materials. With, you know, like lighting, for the next 10 years, we should seriously focus on not allowing mercury to contaminate our environment as we move from mercury-based lamps into other types of lamps. And this distinction about circular economy, while kind of forgetting about the mercury, is problematic to me, Mike. And I think that, you know, that mercury retort, that recapture of mercury, the non-sale of mercury outside of the United States, all these laws exist, but people are kind of becoming obsessed with things that in my mind are of lower importance, right? Like, who cares what happens to the lamp glass? Oh, no. We need to mix that with concrete so it's like a feedstock, and then we recycle it in the sidewalk. It becomes part of a sidewalk. Yeah, that's great. What about the mercury? Right? Oh, you know what? That's not so important to us. What we want to do. No, we need to focus on the things that are key. And Mike, I think that the way we handle hazardous waste is such an indication of our level of intelligence. If we don't take hazardous waste seriously, then I don't know if we should take all these other things seriously. Am I talking crazy here, Mike?
No, you're not. And you actually just reminded me of one of my favorite quotes. It's from John Muir, and it basically says that if you tug on any one thing in the universe, you find it connected to everything else. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always envision tugging on one little thread of the sweater, and you know what happens if you tug too hard? The whole sweater comes apart, right? And what you've done is two things in that statement. You've identified that there is a misunderstanding of what circular really means. Circular should not mean recycling at the end of life. It should not mean singular attributes like how it's recycled, how much is recycled, can it be recycled, is it hazardous. We shouldn't be pigeonholing ourselves there. We should be looking at holistic frameworks where from the very design, we only use hazardous materials when there absolutely is no other alternative whatsoever. So we design those hazardous materials out from the get-go. And then all the way through at every stage, we use a holistic framework like the Living Product Challenge to make sure that when we make an improvement in one area, we're not inadvertently stumbling and pulling on a thread that's going to pull the sweater apart. We shouldn't be having the conversation, frankly, at all, whether what we're going to do with hazardous materials. we should design those out. Nature doesn't provide an overabundance of hazardous materials. Nature provides toxins, which are there as defense mechanisms for certain species, right? It does not provide for these mass amounts of uncontrolled and unnecessary chemicals in our environment that are giving us sickness, causing places like Cancer Valley. We need to emulate nature. We need to be a part of nature and remember that we are wholly dependent upon it while being a part of it. And our product should be that way, and our building should be that way, and our lighting design ought to emulate that as well.
I got bad news.
What's your bad news? I'll try to give you some good news in response.
Okay. So in the race for lumens per watt and for energy efficiency, what the lighting industry has effectively done is increased the life of the light source, but reduced the life cycle of the light fixture. So you have this increase in life of the actual component that produces light. It uses less energy, but at the end of life, that's garbage. And that's the Greg, is that the vast majority of purpose-built light fixtures today? I would say it's the vast majority.
Yeah, it is.
Like, we're not talking about a subset. We're talking about all of it, right? So basically, every single light fixture that's produced today that is not able to handle a traditional light source, meaning an LED tube in the shape of a fluorescent tube or an LED light bulb that screws into a fixture. Anything that's built for LED technology, what you have is an increase in the life of the light source, but e-waste in 5 years. And what I've seen from all the regulatory bodies, Mike, is really an approved, we have a whole bunch of qualified garbage, put it that way. We have a whole bunch of qualified garbage that's going to be, that was qualified 5 years ago or 4 years ago or 6 years ago. But the life cycle of these units, there's no way it can be better for the environment to change out entire light fixtures every 5 or 10 years. That's going backwards in my mind. And in the past, we would maintain those light fixtures at one time with ballast that contained PCBs. Then we got the polychlorinated biphenyls out of the lighting industry, and we had electronic ballasts and different kinds of ballasts, but we had mercury-containing lights. And now those light fixtures would last 40, 50, 60 years sometimes. Change the light bulb, change the light bulb, change the light bulb. And now we have something where the average light fixture lasts 2 or 3 fluorescent tube lives. And that's it. Now you're done. How do we as an industry listen to your message, but change that fact? And then let's throw in China too. Everything's made in China. How do we handle all this stuff as an industry if we want to do what's right?
Yeah. And the lighting industry in this dilemma is no different than almost every other industry. And again, it really goes back to having folks that are well-trained in true sustainability and true design for disassembly and true restorative thinking. Sustainability is often thought about as like the club, right? Or the volunteers at an organization. Sustainability in reality has now matured to the point where lots and lots of the world's best organizations have CSOs or corporate sustainability officers. And that's because those organizations are now thinking on the whole, on that whole interconnected picture that I was referring to. So going back to your comment, if the efficiency in lighting and the longevity of the light source or those LED components are outweighing the environmental costs and the other costs of the fixture having to go to waste, then the breakdown there is in design. The breakdown is in not designing for disassembly, not designing for reparation, not designing to be taken back. And as we talked about earlier, if those lighting sources, those lighting fixtures had to go back to the manufacturers or had a very expensive end-of-life disposition option, then we would eliminate that immediately, whether it's made in China, made in Toronto, made in San Francisco, it wouldn't matter. Because now you would have the responsibility to take back that product. And the more expensive it is to take back, the worse it is for your bottom line next year, the year after, the year after. So we need to get out of this. Again, we need to get out of the linear aspect of thinking. We can no longer accept as human beings that there's 8 billion of us relying on resources that are insufficient already. We can't keep thinking that we can do this linear extraction. We simply can't. The Earth will not provide enough resources at the end of the day, very soon. So really, we need to come together with that holistic thinking and not just focus on operational energy like we did. We need to focus on embodied carbon and embodied energy. We need to focus on reparability. We need to focus on secondary markets. And we need to focus on manufacturers owning all the way through what they made in some way, shape, or form, whether that's lease, product or service, or some sort of extended take-back program that's mandatory and not optional.
And I think that's the key thing I want to point out is there's a lot of organizations that are trying to do things and, you know, make people think and consider doing, but your ultimate goal is to make us do it, right? And force the action.
Well, I mean, if you're asking me personally, yeah, I would love to see enforcement go with voluntary action. Yeah. At the Institute, ILFI, everything that we do is voluntary. We are simply trying to make the most progressive challenges on what defines good so that we can actually all see the end goal. We can actually all see that future we want. There's so much talk right now about future-proofing and resilient design. If you stop and think about that for a minute, isn't that about the most sad statement that we can make as a society? That we're actually now designing for resilience against the very catastrophes that we're causing or we're causing to be worse? That's insanity. That's the definition of insanity. We are buying into a negative spiral that we've created. Why not instead? Why don't we just say, hey, this is the future that we want to live in, that we can embrace, and maybe most importantly, that is worthy of living if you are a child right now, right? Or if you have kids, or you're going to have kids. Let's envision that, and then let's figure out how to get there. I mean, we got to the moon. We can do this. We already have buildings that are making the Earth better because they have been built, and we have products that are making the Earth better because they were produced. This is not theoretical anymore. This is happening and can happen. And we just really got to focus our energies together, pun intended, and do the right thing. It's difficult, but once you do it, your costs go way down. Your costs and your exposures of risks goes way down. Your employee happiness goes way up. The buy-in from your clients and the loyalty from your clients goes way up. It's literally win, 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 win. Everywhere you look, it's wins once you actually do it right. But if you only do it halfway or you do it in a way that's artificial and you get accused of greenwashing for good reason, whew, you got another thing coming.
See, the take I have and what I've learned in, you know, whatever, 6-7 years of doing this podcast is that it depends on the metrics. If, you know, in the metrics from 2014, lumens per watt, the race for energy efficiency, climate change. Let's use the lighting industry as a climate change mitigation advertising machine for us or something. And this race that for lumens per watt ended up creating a whole manner of unintended downstream consequences that have been, quite frankly, Mike, are not only worse, but possibly a magnitude worse, you know? So the lighting industry finds itself in a position now where it's creating not 1%, but 10% more light pollution every single year. The lighting industry finds itself in a position where the average life cycle of a light fixture could be amortized over 25 years. And now you're talking at best 5 to 10 years, and then you're replacing that light fixture. We're in a whole bunch of where we have LED light. We're not sure if that type of radiation is really the type of radiation that should be regulated in the old filament days. and is actually more like lasers than it is like light bulbs. And so are we just blasting each other with lasers? Like, nobody can come to me and give me the argument that LED headlights on cars are good. LED headlights on cars are a catastrophe. You have these laser beams pointing down the road that are literally blinding people. And so the problem I have, and I'm not saying that, you know, your organization is promoting this, the concern I have as somebody that's right in the middle of the industry, that's between the manufacturers and the end user, these people need light bulbs and light fixtures, and they want energy efficiency and they want their light, and these people are selling light fixtures and they want to move stuff down this linear pipeline, is that when we start to tinker at one end, we don't know what the downstream problems are going to be from that tinkering, even though we think we did the right thing. Does that make sense, Mike, what I'm saying there?
100%. And what you're underscoring would be single attribute benefit, single attribute advancement, or single attribute detraction areas where the product can be improved. When we look at things from a holistic design, from the very beginning, the very extraction, all the way to what will happen at the end of life through intention, we remove almost all of those variables. I can't say that we're going to create a magic framework or a magic beanstalk that is going to guide us to the clouds and, you know, and sprinkle down unicorn dust. But what I can say, is there is a tremendous body of science available. Is it flawed in some cases? Absolutely. Is it lacking fullness? Absolutely. But we're getting there, and we're going to make mistakes along the way. But when you were talking, one thing that I wondered if you're involved with, and perhaps if not, you ought to be. There is a lighting industry push right now to create product category rules for life cycle analysis of lighting industry products. And that product category rule will have broad sweeping implications of everything we're talking about, avoiding single attribute pitfalls, making sure that we're measuring like kind to like kind, making sure you mentioned metrics, making sure that the metrics that are being chosen and studied are agreed upon, not just by the users, not just by the manufacturers, but by all stakeholders in the lighting industry. So product category rules, are they perfect? No. But are they a culmination of, generally speaking, the most globally available at any one point in time? Yeah. And when we have an agreed upon PCR that all manufacturers can or must follow, depending upon where you are in the world, then we actually get apples to apples comparison across a holistic look at how a product is made and used. And that's when we can make genuine third-party verified scientific measurement in terms of optimizing or lessening the impacts or optimizing the benefit or both. So if you're not already familiar, that's being driven right now. In fact, I think they're closing the committee this month. And that's being driven by the Pacific National Renewable Energy Laboratory. It's always hard for me to say. Kate Hickok, I believe, is in charge of that one.
Come on, Kate. We love Kate Hickok here on GAFR and Get a Grip on Lighting. Sure. Okay. She's a friend of the show. Yeah. You know, Mike, I the way I look at this is whenever, I always, as a podcaster, I always want to inject a little bit of humility and a little bit of, I don't know what the right word is, respect for frontline practitioners into these arguments. 100%. You know, we have so much disrespect in the lighting industry for people that are on the front lines. It's like the generals versus the soldiers dilemma. You have people that are on the other side, the designers and the manufacturers, and they're brought on all these stakeholder committees and everything else. But they leave out the people that talk to the end user every day. And it happens all the time. And it's such a tragedy. And so, you know, what I want to, like, and I think that, you know, you're a dreamer, you know, Yeah, like a John Lennon, you know, kind of. I love it. I really love it. And I think we need to have these arguments and we need to have these debates. And we're not always going to agree, Mike Johnson. Sometimes we're going to disagree. But we 100%. Have to align ourselves and fight our way to the table. And we have to get there, Greg Eric, as NAILD members. Go to the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors website, Greg Eric, NALD.org. You know, if you guys are out there and you got light bulbs in your warehouse, you need your representation. That's NAILD. We're fighting to get on all these committees, all these stakeholder groups to bring the frontline practitioners' perspective to the table. And of course, we thank Mike Johnson, the Director of Materials of the International Living Future Institute. And of course, Greg, lock it up with gripblocksystems.com.
That's right. No more chain. You don't need that chain. Too hard to deal with. Make it easily adjustable. No tools. Griplock's got you covered.
Griplock's got you covered. Mike Johnson, do you have any final thoughts for our Get a Grip on Lighting listeners before we sign off?
Sure. I always like to leave with, if you're not already personally living and making decisions in your own life on a life cycle thinking standpoint, start. It'll change your world. When you stop wasting food because you understand what went into it, you'll save a lot of money, you'll feel better, and you'll do your family and the planet and the community a whole lot of benefit. Think about that in every way and every aspect, and we're going to get to where we want to be very quickly. Thanks for the time.
No problem. And as my ancestors that were refugees from the first American Rebellion, or as Americans say, the American Revolution, and came to Canada as refugees, they would say, waste not, want not. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.